Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Philip Yun, Executive Director of the Plowshares Fund. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now on to our program. Iran continues to be a major foreign policy challenge for the United States and the international community. Iran just, there was some meetings in Kazakhstan between Iran and international negotiators, which included the United States, and there seemed to be some positive signs from this February meeting. Meanwhile, we have a new Secretary of State, John Kerry, who has expressed support for diplomacy and continued diplomacy, and at the same time, he said that negotiations cannot be endless. In addition, we've had recently Vice President Biden, who talked about and reiterated the U.S. position that it would prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, and that, but that diplomacy was the preferred route. On the other side, part of Washington and Capitol Hill, we have Congress who is pushing, and they're introducing new sanctions, which includes pressures of various kind on the economic, political, and potentially military to try to get Iran to move forward in the way that we hope, as in terms of the United States government, would like Iran to move. So what is going to happen in the coming months? Is there going to be an agreement? Will it be more of the same? To help us with these questions, we have the noted author and Middle East policy expert, Dr. Trita Parsi. Dr. Parsi is the founder and president of the National Iranian American Relations Council. Dr. Parsi was born in Iran, but his family fled to Sweden when he was 4 to escape political repression. We have had the chance to talk a little bit beforehand. We've known Trita. He is a grantee of the Plowshares Fund. And things that people may not know is that he was actually in Sweden until his early 20s, and he is fluent in Swedish. As an adult, he moved to the United States and studied his doctoral thesis under Francis Fukuyama at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Parsi had extensive experience on Capitol Hill and at the United Nations. He has been published in the New York Times, Financial Times, and Wall Street Journal and other leading journals, and he has appeared on CNN, Al Jazeera, the PBS NewsHour, and the Jon Stewart Show. It was a great appearance, by the way, let me say. Dr. Parsi's latest book, A Single Roll of the Dice, President Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, was named Best Book on the Middle East for 2012 by Foreign Affairs. Please welcome Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Phil, for that very kind introduction. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me here, and thank you all for coming here today to listen to a talk and a conversation about the situation with Iran. I want to give you guys a bit of a heads up, though. This may not be the most thrilling presentation. Be prepared to be a bit depressed, because this is not a particularly uplifting subject, unfortunately. There is, however, some silver linings in all of this, and some elements of hope that I hope that we can explore today in order to be able to find a way going forward that will avoid the type of military confrontations that I assume most people in this country and elsewhere would like to avoid. The topic of the United States and Iran has continued to puzzle and frustrate both of the countries for the last 33 years. And we are in a phase in which it's coming to more or less a climax. The type of a low-grade conflict that has existed for the last 3 decades can no longer exist for much longer. At some point, there has to be a shift, either towards the resolution of this conflict or, unfortunately, a gravitation towards some sort of a confrontation. And in the last 4 years, there was a tremendous amount of hope that things would take a turn for the better. With the election of President Obama, there was a perception and a hope that a new approach would be pursued, and that new approach most likely would lead to a result that has been different from what we have seen in the past. In fact, to President Obama's credit, he only waited approximately 12 minutes in his presidency before he did his first outreach to the Iranians. In his inaugural speech in 2009, in January, he stated that he would extend America's hand of friendship to Iran if Iran unclenched its fist. And immediately thereafter, a very intense period followed in which the administration put together a new strategy. They did a lot to change the atmospheric between the two countries. But unfortunately, for factors that were not completely in their control, things happened that delayed the process of diplomacy and caused a lot of time to be lost, primarily, of course, the fraudulent elections that took place in Iran in 2009. Massive fraud followed by massive human rights abuses that literally put the Iranian elite at war with itself as well as with large portions of the society. This paralyzed the Iranians, and diplomacy could not begin until October 2009, 10 months into the president's first year. And he had expected only to have about a year to get a breakthrough. So now diplomacy started at the last possible hour. And what we've seen in the last couple of years, and as we have seen also in the previous three decades, the conflict between the United States and Iran is complex, but it's not the most complex issue that humanity has ever encountered. The real complexity is not the technical aspects of the nuclear issue, it's the domestic politics of both sides, as well as the politics that involves other countries in the region. After three decades, both sides have essentially institutionalized the enmity. Plenty of folks have made their careers by thinking of new ways to be nasty to the other. And there is a status quo that has been quite beneficial for a lot of other regional neighbors of Iran. And there's a fear that if there is a breakthrough, what will that really entail for the other countries in the region? Will it be a benefit or will it be a disadvantage to the other states? And in the last 4 years in particular, we saw something very, very interesting. We saw how domestic politics on both sides caused two major opportunities to be lost. In 2009, when the United States for the first time began negotiations with Iran, over the course of 3 weeks, two and a half meetings were held. Unfortunately, they did not lead to any results, which largely was because of the fact that the Iranian elite was still at war with itself, and none of the other elements within Iran's political elite wanted to see any deal with the United States that potentially could help Ahmadinejad, Iran's disputed president, gain more political leverage at home. And they moved in to make it more or less impossible for that deal to be had. 7 months later, the tables are turned. Turkey and Brazil, two countries in the Security Council, non-permanent members, decide that they're going to give another go at diplomacy and try to see if the Iranians would agree to the deal that the U.S. had put in front of them 7 months earlier with a minor alteration. And lo and behold, after 18 hours of negotiations, the Iranians agreed. But what the Turks and the Brazilians did not know was that 2 days before they had arrived in Tehran, the Security Council states, Russia and China, had come to an agreement on a new UN sanctions resolution against Iran. And the White House had to decide between a UN sanctions resolution or a breakthrough in the nuclear field, in the negotiations. Because of domestic political reasons more than anything else, this is, mind you, 6 months before the next midterm elections, the president chose to go forward with the sanctions instead of the breakthrough in the talks. And this was, again, because of domestic politics, as was the case in Iran. We have been close. Both sides have managed to get close to the negotiations, even resolve some of the technical complexities of this issue. But last minute, because of domestic political constellations, things have turned out to be too difficult. There is a reason to believe that 2013, or at least parts of 2014, may be the period, may be the year in which something can be achieved, precisely because both sides are now experiencing greater political space than they will for the next 4 years. The president just started his second term. The first year of his second term tends to be the best year when it comes to political space and maneuverability. The Iranians are having their elections in a couple of months, and we'll see what will happen with that. But there has been an additional effort now for diplomacy, and for the first time in Kazakhstan about 2 weeks ago, a minor breakthrough seemed to have been achieved. There's a lot of hope right now that in the next meeting in Istanbul, in about a week or two, and then a follow-up meeting in Kazakhstan again on April 5th, something can be achieved. And the immediate issue that has to be addressed is the fact that the Iranians are enriching uranium to about 20%. We can go into the greater details of why that is critical. But what that does, particularly with the new centrifuge that they have installed in the last couple of months, it means that the amount of time for Iran to try to build a bomb, which up until this point was estimated to be about 12 months, for them to dash out and enrich uranium up to 93% and build a bomb, has now been significantly reduced because the Iranians have increased their enrichment at 20% level and have now more efficient centrifuges. If an agreement can be found, which is within reach, to stop Iran's enrichment at 20%, then a major breakthrough will have been obtained. And that would throw back the timeline for any potential breakthrough, breakout capacity for the Iranians, and give a significant amount of additional time and space for further negotiations to be able to fully resolve this issue. The Iranians have indicated extensively, repeatedly, they're willing to stop 20%. What they want in return, however, can become a bit tricky. What they want in return is the lifting of some of the sanctions that the Obama administration has imposed on Iran, which have been tremendously crippling when it comes to hurting the Iranian economy. The trick in all of this is that most of these sanctions cannot be lifted by the president. It can only be lifted by Congress. And anyone who owns a TV set knows that Congress and the president are not best friends forever right now. And this is again where the domestic political aspects of this come in. Because we may once again be at the threshold of a great achievement, a great breakthrough in the next couple of weeks. But if we cannot deliver from our end here in the United States something to the Iranians that they view as strategically significant, they are likely not going to give up things that they believe we value as strategically significant. And getting the ability to have that give and take is exactly what diplomacy is about. I'll stop here, and we'll carry on a conversation.
Okay, great. Thank you for those opening remarks. So what we usually like to do, and what I like to do, is for people to understand a little bit more about your perspective. And I also want to talk about, you know, your book, which was very, very well received, and to ask you about kind of the motivation behind that. This is your second book. Again, the first one was very well received as well. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about your thinking behind that, and for those who have not read it, sort of what your main arguments are and what you'd like them to take away from it?
Sure. I was one of those who was quite optimistic and enthused about the election of Obama and the prospects of a breakthrough between the United States and Iran, for several different reasons. One being that I believe that it's critical that the tension between the United States and Iran is reduced in order to get the domestic political process of moving away from the very authoritarian system that currently exists in Iran towards something more democratic. It's very difficult for the Iranian pro-democracy movement to make headway under these circumstances in which there is a constant threat of war between the United States and Iran. But as I explained, the hopes that many had did not materialize. And I decided about a year into this that it would be very interesting to do a book that would look into exactly what happened. Why did diplomacy not achieve what it was supposed to achieve? Was diplomacy truly exhausted? There's some people who make the argument that diplomacy has been exhausted and we have to move on to other options. I did interviews with, I think, altogether about 70 officials from almost all of the involved countries. I sat down with folks from the U.S. government and the Obama administration at the top level, to the Saudis, the Israelis, the Europeans, the Russians, to, of course, the Iranians themselves. I had the opportunity to interview the negotiators from all sides, including also the Turks and the Brazilians, to get a 360-degree image of what actually happened. What were the mistakes? What were the miscalculations that were made that has led to a situation in which this opportunity was missed? And one of my significant takeaways is that we cannot say that diplomacy in any way, shape, or form has been exhausted. At best, it's been abandoned, again because of domestic political factors. The type of diplomacy that we have seen the United States successfully conduct in other places was very different from what we saw between the United States and Iran. In fact, to just give you an idea of how little interaction there has been between the two sides, the Obama administration has spent more time negotiating with the Taliban than with Tehran. The title of my book is A Single Roll of the Dice. It's actually a direct quote from one of Obama's top officials who told me that by the time the administration managed to get all of the parties to the table in October 2009, the entire policy had become a gamble on a single roll of the dice. It had to work right away or not at all. And there is no such thing as instantaneous fast food diplomacy. Diplomacy takes time, diligence, persistence. And that neither the U.S. or Iran have been capable of mustering, again, because of the domestic political cost that exists on both sides for pursuing the type of diplomacy that is necessary in order to succeed.
So why don't we talk a little bit about these domestic costs and the domestic politics that's involved. I mean, from your remarks earlier, you seem to indicate from a technical level there was an overlap that seemed, and when you talk with people who are involved in this, there seems to be a deal out there that can be had purely on the technical aspects related to Iran's nuclear activities and a way in which to move forward. But we keep on hearing about domestic politics. So why don't you fill that in on both sides, both within the United States and really within Iran itself. And then also, as a couple of questioners asked about, was the domestic politics in Iran with the presidential election coming up?
Absolutely. If we start off with the Iranian side, it's a very complex situation there. And just to simplify it, I think one can say that on the one hand, you do have elements that are ideologically opposed to the idea of the United States and Iran reestablishing relations. Then you have elements that I think are more influential and more important that are extremely skeptical and suspicious about the U.S.'s intentions and as a result, in practice, end up behaving similar to the first group. They're so skeptical about the chances of success, so they're not willing to take that risk for peacemaking that is necessary to take if you want to get anywhere. And then you have, I think, the biggest factor, which is many of the elements the different political factions in Iran calculate that whichever president or leader manages to resolve the issue with the United States in a meaningful and honorable way, meaning that Iran does not end up capitulating, will end up having his or her, well, actually his, political bona fide significantly strengthened. And that means that no political faction is willing to see a competing political faction succeed in doing this. Whenever there has been deals that have been close to being had, you've seen how a competing faction have done something to undermine it. And it's very easy to undermine this very fragile process. The first and perhaps best example of this, which gave the United States a very, very bad taste in the mouth when it came to dealing with the Islamic Republic, was during the Iran-Contra scandal, in which very extensive negotiations were being held with one faction of the Iranian government, and the U.S. at the moment, at that time, did not have a clear idea of the landscape, the political landscape within the Iranian elite. And what ended up happening was that a competing faction leaked the story to a Lebanese paper, which then, of course, made it to the United States, and then you had the Iran-Contra scandal. President Reagan, who had said that he would never deal with terrorists or negotiate for the release of American hostages, and who had imposed an arms embargo on Iran, was secretly negotiating in order to get out American hostages in Lebanon and offering very sophisticated American weaponry to the Iranians as the payment for that. And this, of course, almost took down the Reagan administration and has caused a tremendous amount of apprehension on the U.S. side about the difficulty and the risk that involves dealing with Iranians. Then on the U.S. side, you have a situation in which, you know, I don't have to explain too much in detail about what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now in Congress, but, you know, the partisan atmosphere that exists right now that probably is unprecedented is certainly not helpful. In addition to that, you have a lot of members of the president's own party who are also very, very skeptical about the value of negotiating with Iran, about the prospects of success, but also about the potential risks that exist in case there is a deal with Iran. Because I think these elements recognize that in any deal with the Iranians that is sustainable, Iran will retain a certain degree of enrichment capabilities on its own soil. That is a deviation from the zero enrichment objective that the Bush administration had. Part of the reason why they never managed to attain it was because it was an unattainable objective. But if you get a deal in which the Iranians have enrichment capability, the argument reads, then the Iranians will have a breakout capability. Iran will become some form of a virtual nuclear power that will be sufficient to shift the balance of power in the region to Iran's benefit, to a certain extent to America's disadvantage, but primarily to the disadvantage of Israel. And as a result of this, you have a tremendous amount of hesitation and outright opposition to a deal. We saw that in the last round of negotiations in 2012. At the table, the U.S. made some indications that at the end of the process, if the Iranians agree to the right type of inspections and limitation to their program, the U.S. could live with limited enrichment on Iranian soil. 2 weeks after, Congress passes a resolution that makes it very clear that the Congress's position is absolutely no enrichment in Iran. And this undermined the president's ability to negotiate. Because at the end of the day, if he is to deliver his end of the bargain, he has to have the capability of delivering that end of the bargain. And if Congress is opposed to him, and mindful of the fact that the Congress has been quite successful in undermining other things that the president wants to do, a question mark has emerged in the heads of the Iranian, which is, can Obama deliver on his promises? And again, you see here how the domestic politics is making a resolvable conflict far, far more complex than it needs to be.
Can you talk a little bit more about the coming elections in Iran and what you think is going to happen? And is that, depending on the outcome, what would be good for negotiations and perhaps not so good for negotiations?
By rule, I only predict Iranian elections about a week or two after they have taken place. That's just the safest career-advancing advice I can give anyone who wants to look into Iran. And there's very little, frankly, that can be said right now. We still don't know exactly who, A, the candidates will be who have announced their candidacy, and we have to see if they will get approved, because Iran does not have a democratic system. They have a body called the Guardian Council that has to vet and approve the candidates. And a trend that we have seen and that I suspect we will see significantly intensified is that the candidates that will end up becoming approved are candidates that are so within the Iran's existing political elite or within the very narrow perspective that the supreme leader of Iran has, that there really isn't much of a choice between them. But it remains to be seen, but that's one suspicion. I think, to be frank, the elections in Iran don't have too much of an upside. I don't think there's anything in particular that can happen that suddenly would make things much, much easier, with the exception of the fact that if Iran's next president does not have any particular theories about the Holocaust, and even if he does, he keeps it to himself, that would certainly create greater political opportunities in the sense that the political cost of dealing with the Iranians would be reduced. I think with someone like Ahmadinejad, and mindful of the things that he said, he's become completely untouchable. No Western politician wants to have anything even close to a photo op or a handshake with Ahmadinejad, understandably. So having him outside of the picture in that sense could be helpful. But other than that, I don't think it makes a huge difference. The downside is much greater in the sense that if in the next election you have another round of fraud. The elections are not even anything close to being elections. And you have more infighting within the political elites, more repression and human rights abuses, Iran being more paralyzed politically, we will again lose time because diplomacy will not take place. But even when the elite in Iran is divided, we have seen the nuclear program is unaffected. So the nuclear program will continue to advance, but we'll have a situation in Iran in which diplomacy really cannot take place. That risk, I think, is not insignificant, and it's quite worrisome, to be frank.
We have a number of questions which are just fantastic here. One is, I think, that's coming up a lot is the issue of trust. What do you say to those individuals, particularly those in the United States, who argue a deal with Iran is basically useless, that the Iran government can't be trusted, cannot be relied upon to fulfill its promises, just see what's happened over the last several years. And then some of those who talk about, Iran in many ways is irrational. And they talk about dominating the Middle East. And then, again, they point to some of Ahmadinejad's sort of outrageous and inflammatory statements about the Holocaust, about Israel. What's your perspective on that?
I think those are very important issues to address. If we start off with can they be trusted, I think it's very, very important to understand that any deal at this stage, after 33 years of enmity, a tremendously deep trust gap that exists between the two sides, this is not going to be about trusting the other side. It's going to be about trusting the mechanisms in the deal that verifies that the other side lives up to its end of the bargain. Ronald Reagan used to say, trust but verify. Well, in this case, perhaps we can say mistrust and verify. But bottom line is, verification is the critical component. We also know from other negotiations that trust is not something you can buy at Kmart. Trust is built over a period of time in which you have these verification processes in place. There is a more intense degree of interaction between the two sides. And slowly but surely, and particularly with time, trust can be built. Both sides have very good reasons to mistrust the other. Every time an opportunity has been missed or lost, you have seen the trust gap become even deeper. But at the end of the day, if trust was a precondition for international deals, we would probably not have seen any peace treaties under any circumstances. It's about the verification process within the deal that enables us to get past disputes and be able to build a better future. It is not to dismiss the issue of trust. It's very critical. It's making this much more difficult. But it's important to understand it is not about putting trust into the other side. It's about putting trust into the mechanisms of the deal that helps you verify that no one is cheating. And the Iranians, incidentally, will want to have those mechanisms as well. The key objection they had to the 2009 deal that the U.S. put in front of the Iranians together with allies in the P5+1 was exactly because of that issue. Just to very briefly tell you, in 2009, the U.S. asked the Iranians to give up 1,200 kilos of its LEU, low-enriched uranium, that would then be turned into fuel pads by Russia and France. Iran would not get the fuel pads back until about 9 to 12 months later because that's how long it takes to produce them. And the Iranians said no, partly because what were the guarantees that once the West had taken Iran's LEU, it would give the fuel pads back? Because of a lack of trust and because of a lack of a mechanism in that specific deal that eliminated incentive for the West to renege on the deal, we saw that the domestic political elements in Iran had a very easy time shooting down that deal. The other thing is about the issue of rationality. This is an argument that most oftentimes is heard in the media, in the public discourse. It is not an argument that you hear that often in conversations with officials. Certainly not with the Obama administration officials. Because at the end of the day, to be frank with you, it's not really about rationality, irrationality. The Iranians have their logic. If you take a look at what the military and the intelligence assessment of the Iranians are, it's very clear they believe that they are trying to maximize their interests, that they're pursuing a cost-benefit analysis. And if it is true that the Iranians were irrational, and add one other component to it that oftentimes is heard in the debate, which is that they're irrational and suicidal, we have to answer the question, why have they in that case then passed on 33 years of opportunities to commit suicide, if they truly are suicidal? In fact, part of the problems I think we're faced with, and this is, I'm paraphrasing an Israeli official that I interviewed, is actually the opposite. That they're actually very, very cunning, very Machiavellian. They don't have the best cards, but they play them quite well. They have overplayed them on many occasions, as have we, and that's why we've missed so many opportunities. But this is not a situation in which truly you can point to the empirical facts and say that they're not that they're irrational. Now, let's be also clear. Rationality should not be confused with being pleasant or anything like that. Oftentimes, we see very horrible things they say. We dislike that, and we can reject that, but that doesn't mean necessarily that there's irrationality on the other side. They have simply different opinions. I'll go one step further and say that I suspect that the argument of irrationality and that the fact that they're mad mullahs seeking suicide are politically motivated arguments aimed at pushing the options of the West in a specific direction. Ask yourself, if you assume that your opponent is irrational, what are the policy options that you have just eliminated by virtue of that assumption? If you assume that the other side is irrational, you're not going to pursue diplomacy. You're probably not also going to pursue deterrence, because it requires rationality on the other side to be able to deter them. If you then add the fact, or the idea, the argument that they're suicidal, what are you left with then? Well, you're certainly not going to pursue containment, deterrence, or diplomacy with an irrational, suicidal opponent. The only option you're left with is preventive war. And I suspect, frankly, that the arguments about irrationality, etc., is aimed at pushing the West, particularly the United States, in that direction, rather than having sound empirical basis.
So let's talk a two-part question here. One has to do with the factual issue about how close Iran is it really to having a nuclear weapon capability and a weapon, operational weapon. And then talk about intent, because I know that there are different sort of formulations. There's some disagreement about that, and I'm wondering what your view. This is these are a few questions that reflect that sort of direction.
I hosted an event just the other day on Capitol Hill with Professor Kota Ramosino. He is the head of Pugwash, which is an organization of nuclear scientists that won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1996 for the work that they've done to reduce nuclear weapons worldwide. And he was asked this question, and he's a nuclear physicist. He can build a nuclear bomb in his basement. So I kind of take his word for it. And he said he doesn't really trust any of the different assessments that exist, because they're all assumption dependent. Based on the assumptions that you make on the other side of what they have, etc., you can come to almost any conclusion about how far away they are or how close they are to a bomb. But I can share with you what the assumption or the belief in the White House has been, at least up until last month or so, which is that with the capabilities that the Iranians had, if they were to cheat, they would have enough nuclear material for one bomb within 6 to 12 months. However, because of the current level of inspections, which is not sufficient, but nevertheless, with the current level of inspections, the Iranians would get caught within 30 to 60 days, meaning that at worst, they would be caught 1/6 of the road towards a bomb, or within 1/3 of the road towards a bomb. So that's part of the reason why, from the White House's perspective, they weren't thrilled about the situation, but they were not panicking, because they knew that with the current level of inspections, if the Iranians tried to do so, we would catch them well in time in order to be able to do something about it. With the Iranians now installing new centrifuges that are much more efficient, that calculation changes. And that's a very negative development, which makes it all the more important to be able to get a deal on the 20%.
Okay. So before our next question, I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and that you are listening to Dr. Trita Parsi, author of A Single Roll of the Dice, President Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Dr. Parsi is founder and president of the National Iranian-American Relations Council. Next set of questions have to do with sanctions. And there are a number of questions that talk about that are directed at the effectiveness of sanctions. Are they really doing anything? What is the goal of sanctions in your mind, and what should be the role of sanctions?
In Washington, I'm probably in a bit of a minority when it comes to the assessment of the sanctions. I know outside of Washington I'm not, but Washington is its own creature in many different ways. I'm very skeptical about the proportion of our sanctions policy. There's no doubt that sanctions have had a tremendously crippling effect on the Iranian economy. Sanctions have helped reduce the value of the Iranian currency with about 70%. Iran's oil exports have dropped about 50% as a result of the sanctions. Additional trade is becoming increasingly difficult for the Iranians as well, because they're more or less shut out from the international financial system. Nevertheless, in spite of that, we have not seen any of this pain translate into a change of Iran's nuclear calculus. On the contrary, if you take a look at the last IAEA report, we see a repetition of a pattern that by now is almost two decades old. Sanctions have been the favorite way for the West to put pressure on Iran for it to cease activities that we find troublesome. The Iranians respond with pressure. They respond to pressure with pressure, and their counter pressure is to intensify exactly the activities that we don't like. So we put sanctions on them because of their nuclear activities. In order for them to gain leverage, they intensify their nuclear activities. And the example of it, the last round, was that the Iranians installed these new centrifuges that will make the efficiency of their nuclear work all the greater. And we've seen this escalation, this perpetual escalation go on for quite some time now. I find it very troublesome because it's extremely difficult to break out of. And the problem is that over time, both sides have run out of escalation options. The Iranians have fewer and fewer options. The problem, though, is that the remaining options are more and more dangerous. For every new option that they could put into place in order to counter-pressure the West, they're getting far, far closer to a breakout capability. Moreover, as we have continued this escalation cycle, our de-escalatory options are also reduced. And in my view, actually, this is the process that I'm most worried about that could lead to a military confrontation. I don't believe there is a desire in this White House for a military confrontation with Iran. But war is not always a decision. Oftentimes, it's actually because of circumstances, not because of a deliberate effort to go towards war. And I'm fearful that if we continue this effort, this escalation cycle, without being able to dial it back or have more nuance in it, we'll end up in a situation in which the final escalatory step that is left there is to take military action.
So you talk about military action. Why don't we've had some sessions here at the Commonwealth Club about that, but from your perspective, Tell us, in your mind, what you believe the consequences are of a military attack or the use of force and things that we all need to consider. I know that there has been a lot of talk about Iraq earlier in, 10 years ago, and when it was not really very well thought out. In fact, there was not really a national discussion on what the implications of a military conflict were going was going to be. And so this is something I think you and others are trying to fill in that space to have a rational discussion. So your comments on that.
Indeed, I think it's a very important conversation to have. And I think there's been some great work by many in Washington. I know that Ambassador Lewis was here at earlier speaking about the Iran report on this issue. And I think those are tremendously valuable reports that they have produced. And others have written extensively about what the various consequences could be. So let me just sum up some of their arguments and add one of my own that I think, unfortunately, has received far less attention. Very few people make the argument that this would be a particularly easy military operation. The idea that this would be surgical strikes simply is not true in the American context. The Israelis may try a surgical strike, but it's not in the modus operandi of the U.S. military to pursue surgical strikes against targets or elements that have retaliatory capabilities. When they have retaliatory capabilities, you have to do force protection. You need to take out their retaliatory capabilities in order to reduce any potential casualties on the U.S. side. And that very quickly then gets into a full-scale war. And in a testimony about a month ago by the deputy chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, he mentioned, I believe the number he threw out was 500,000 troops, an invasion from three different directions, and an occupation of Iran for about 10 years. This is the military assessment. And then that does not account for all of the spillover effects that are very difficult to predict. We've seen already now how a war in Iraq has now spread al-Qaeda all over the Middle East, how an invasion, or not an invasion, but military intervention in Libya led to a tremendous amount of weapons caches falling into the hand of al-Qaeda, which then showed up in Algeria, etc., etc. So there are some tremendously difficult repercussions of this. I think the safest thing is to say that it's going to be pretty messy and very, very difficult to deal with, and it will not. The repercussions will not have a military solution. That's important to understand. The other factor, though, that is less discussed, which I find very unfortunate, but it's important to point out, is what does this do to Iran's pro-democracy, indigenous pro-democracy movement? Iran is a country that has had a pro-democracy movement since 1906, since its constitutional revolution. It's not been a particularly fast process, given, but it has made progress, and at times it has faced tremendous setbacks. One of those, of course, was in 1953, in which Iran actually did have a democratically elected prime minister, the first one, Mohammad Mossadegh. He was unfortunately unseated by a coup of the CIA and the British MI6. And then we had 37 years of the Shah's reign, and then, of course, the revolution and this current political system that in many ways is even more repressive than the previous one. But throughout all of this, Iran has had a very strong civil society. During the Khatami years, more than 8,000 registered NGOs, a very, the components, the building stones, the building blocks of a democracy certainly were there. And he had more promise for a genuine indigenous democracy than almost any other country in the Muslim Middle East, at least. What will happen to them if there is an invasion or a war? According to themselves, they believe that a military confrontation would set back the cause of democracy in Iran for at least a generation or two. They cannot survive a war because when you have the securitized atmosphere that follows a war, the first victims are those fighting for political and civil rights. The first victims are those who are challenging the political establishment. I think we noticed that ourselves after 9/11, and we saw laws being passed that most likely would not have been passed under any other circumstances. We have to take these factors into consideration as well, because ultimately, it's very difficult to envision a good, firm, sustainable, valuable relationship between the United States and Iran, absent a democratic governing system in Iran. It's also difficult to see how we will have a stable Middle East if one of its most powerful countries, Iran, remains a non-democratic entity. These are factors, again, that while we're thinking about troops and costs, etc., in terms of treasury, we have to take into account as well, in my opinion.
So we had a number of questions essentially on what I would characterize in some ways the opposition, its students, its intellectuals, it's the context of the Arab Spring, and young people in terms of what is the future then? What's the status of the Green Revolution? And what are, I guess essentially if I could distill it, is what is the implication of the Arab Spring and the things that are happening in the Middle East, which is something very, very powerful for Iran and possibly on future policy?
The region as a whole is going through a tremendous amount of change right now. And the Arab Spring, or the movements, at least initially, seem to give some promise of the Green movement in Iran being resurrected. Having spoken to people in Iran who were quite critical in the Green movement in 2009, and both at the organizational level and at the street level, it's been very saddening to see that many of them have come out and said, look, right now, as a result of the economic downturn due to sanctions, we really don't have time to think about politics. We are too busy just trying to make ends meet. Our income has dropped 50%, and we're just running around trying to make sure that we can put food on the table. So things such as talking about political liberalization and social and political rights is a luxury that we no longer can afford under these circumstances. And this, incidentally, should not be a surprise. We've seen that type of a phenomena in other places. There's a reason why most democracies have a certain GDP per capita. You have to reach a certain threshold in order to make sure that the population is ready and is willing to push for those type of political changes. And in Iran, we've seen the reverse happening in the last couple of years. Having said that, I think it's also important to realize that the movement and the desire for political change in Iran is by no means dead. It's more in a pause mode, perhaps one could say, and to put in a perhaps positive spin, they're exercising a strategy that I think we on this side are not particularly familiar with. It's called patience. It means that when you don't have options that are good and you cannot create those options, then you have to wait patiently in order for those options to emerge as a result of unpredictable and unexpected developments. In many ways, I think that is what's happening. I would be very surprised, in fact, I can say with authority, people are tremendously unhappy with the political system as it exists right now, but they're also calculating. There is no value for them to take to the streets if the prospects of success under the current circumstances are minimal. So they have to think it through. They have to take a step back, figure out new strategies. And if they can't come up with one right away, they have to wait. And I think that's what they're doing.
Set of questions deal with, in certain ways, who's in charge and the Supreme Leader Khamenei. And one has, it is well known and it has been talked about how the Supreme Leader has declared a fatwa that nuclear weapons are not permissible and has stated publicly that they are not desirable. And he's also said they are against against Islam. That's sort of on one hand, and then you have the behavior that's sort of ongoing. You also have, on the other hand, you have the president, in this case Ahmadinejad, sort of working contrary to some of the declared notions. So can you give us a sense of the dynamic that's going on here? Are there competing factions, or is there a specific sphere and role that the president has versus the supreme leader? Is there, in a sense, a competition between these political and religious factions? Can you help us, from your perspective, kind of clarify that?
The only thing that probably would make the current atmosphere in Washington, in Congress, between the two parties, between Congress and the executive branch, look healthy and cordial is if you compare it to the current Iranian political system. Just about 2 weeks ago, Ahmadinejad comes into the parliament with a videotape that he says is describing the brother of the Speaker of the Parliament offering bribes in return for political favors. And by that, true or not, but it seemed to actually have been true, he more or less killed the political future, at least the chances of the Speaker of Parliament to run for president. And it seems like he is very methodologically going through all other potential candidates that oppose his faction. And so far we have not seen anything like that happen in Congress, and let's be grateful for that. So it is a tremendously intense, divisive political system. But it's also fascinating to see that in spite of all of their extremely deep divisions, when it comes to some of the red lines on the nuclear issue, we are not seeing a lot of divergence. None of the political factions are favoring a deal that would not entail having enrichment on Iranian soil. And just as much as giving too much to the Iranians would be political suicide in the United States, regardless of which party you belong to, the similar phenomena exist on the Iranian side, again, in spite of all of their other divisions. And I think there's been a lot of hope, perhaps, to see the political divisions in Iran lead to some form of divisions on the nuclear issue, and so far we have not seen that. And I think there's reasons why that hasn't happened. That is also to do with what we're doing and not doing. I think, for instance, if we had been more open about offering sanctions relief to the Iranians if they change their behavior, meaningful, proportionate sanctions relief, I would personally not be surprised if we would start seeing processes and developments within the divisions of the Iranian political system that we so far have not seen. They simply don't see much of an incentive for themselves to change their position right now, since sanctions relief, to the extent that they want at least, has not been put on the table. And then you had a question which was in regards to the fatwa. Let me just quickly address that. I have no religious credentials whatsoever. So I cannot speak in any way, shape, or form authoritatively as to whether a fatwa needs to be written, if it needs to be on a website, who needs to sign it, what's the size of the stamp that needs to be on it, etc. I have no idea about these things. But I think it's very interesting to see how the Obama administration, in my view, quite cleverly have taken advantage of the fatwa. Because think about it. If the Iranians are coming out and saying not only do they not want a nuclear weapon, they think it would be a sin to have it, to build it, or to use it. That's a better starting point to have a situation as we have with North Korea, in which they actually think it's a pretty good thing to have it, and as of late, even talking about potentially using it.
And it's in their constitution, by the way. Yeah.
So what the administration has essentially said in the negotiations has been, that's great. We're very pleased to hear that you think that. Now, how can we create an objective mechanism that ensures and give confidence to people who don't understand what fatwas are, that this is more than just a religious decree, that this is something that is implemented and is ways for outside world to feel confidence in its implementation. And that's the approach that they have taken. And again, the result of that, of course, is that there has to be inspections and verification system. This is a way to also save face for the Iranians then. And I think even though they have been saying this since 2005, I think, it's not until the Obama administration came in that they actually took advantage of that and say, well, that's great, but, you know, for those who are not Muslims, how can we feel any confidence in this? What are the objective mechanisms we can put into place for us to know that this will be verified and that this will not be broken? And I think that's a smart approach to this. You're taking something that otherwise could become quite meaningless and you're turning it into a potential positive.
There are a number of questions related to Israel. And let me ask the question this way. Normalizing U.S.-Iran relations likely requires a lowering of hostilities between Iran and Israel. What would it take for Iran to reduce hostilities with Israel, and do you believe that that's possible?
I think it is possible. I think it is tremendously difficult, however. A couple of years ago, it was easier because then the Iranians themselves were sending signals to the Israelis directly, actually. They were talking about something that they called the Malaysian profile, that Iran would move away from this position of having such a hostile and venomous rhetoric against the Israelis and adopt a profile similar to that of Malaysia, one in which it is a Muslim country, it does not recognize Israel de jure, but it is very careful not to put itself on the forefront in any type of criticism or entanglement with Israel, which would be not a resolution to their conflict, but it would be a significant reduction of their tensions. That opportunity, incidentally, was missed. And to be frank, we don't know if the Khatami government really could have delivered, but it is definitely interesting to see that the rhetoric that existed during the Khatami era is so different from the rhetoric that has now been in place for 8 years under Ahmadinejad. Khatami had no comments about the Holocaust, and in fact, he condemned Ahmadinejad's denial of the Holocaust. Khatami tended to phrase and frame Iran's position vis-à-vis Israel as one showing sympathy for the Palestinians rather than the position that Ahmadinejad has taken, which is to deny Israel's right to exist. And at the end of the day, these type of nuances do make a difference. It is not, in my view, sufficient to be able to make both sides satisfied, obviously, but it is an indication that there are potential openings, things that can be moved. But again, none of this can be done unless diplomacy is given the type of time and persistence needed to fully explore what these things can mean. And just to remind everyone here in the room what diplomacy has required in other cases, let me just give you three examples. It took the United States 4 years to normalize relations with Vietnam after the Vietnam War, after the death of more than 50,000 American troops. These negotiations took place between 1990 and 1994, over the course of two presidents. Another 6 years to get a full trade agreement. It took exactly, almost to the day, 7 years to convince the Libyans to capitulate their nuclear program. Over long periods of time, those negotiations were kept on ice because of political issues in both the countries. But they were eventually picked up and eventually led to a result. There's a wonderful quote from Senator Mitchell, who mediated the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland that put an end to the fighting there. He said on Charlie Rose that for the first 700 days, both sides told him that they would never agree to anything that the other side would agree to. On the 701st day, both of them changed their mind. And fortunately for the people of Northern Ireland and everyone else, Senator Mitchell had the backbone, the strength, the persistence, and the political space to pursue this otherwise non-promising path until it reached a conclusion. And that's the type of commitment we need to have to diplomacy in order to make it succeed. And incidentally, it's no different from the commitment we would need to have to a military campaign. No one would ever make the argument that we're going to go to war, but only for 3 weeks. If it doesn't reach a conclusion, you know, we have to give up. No one would ever make that. But Congress was telling the president in 2009 that they would only permit negotiations to take place for 12 weeks. Afterwards, it had to be declared a failure. We're not treating these options in a similar way. And we are ultimately the biggest losers of that.
There are several questions about NIAC itself, the National Iranian American Council. The United States is a nation of immigrants. There are many organizations that are comprised of ethnic Americans, and I believe they have a very important role, not only within domestic policy, but certainly within foreign policy, dealing with their land of ancestry. And so I think it would be really good for you to take a few minutes. We have a few minutes to talk a little bit about NIAC. People wanted to know more about NIAC, how you got involved, and the history of it.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak about that. I and about three or four other people co-founded NIAC a couple of months after 9/11, 2001. 9/11 was actually one of the motivating factors, and part of the reason for that was that the Iranian-American community at the time had been in the United States for a little bit more than two decades. Very successful community, truly have been able to benefit from all of the greatness of America and live the American dream. But it's a community that has been extremely shy politically, dating back from the hostage crisis to just the general difficulties that the community at times have felt, or to be frank with you, more of a self-marginalization. Politics was never a winning career for anyone in Iran, and coming to the United States, they kind of brought that that legacy with them. But after 9/11, we felt that it was critical to enable the community to at least have a voice in which it can contribute to the discourse that takes place in the United States, both for its own sake, because one of the first laws that were passed in Congress after 9/11 was the Enhanced Border Security Act. It rendered visas to Iranians almost impossible, even though Iranians had nothing to do with 9/11. It did not target visas for Saudis or Egyptians. And, you know, there was a sense that, you know, this doesn't make a lot of sense. But reality is, in the absence of participation in the political system, these are the things that happen. But there was also the realization that the United States was now getting far, far more deeply involved in the Middle East. And one of the most important countries in the Middle East is Iran. And for 20 years, the United States and Iran had had no embassies, no presence, no knowledge of each other. We had lost so many folks in the State Department that knew anything about the other side. But then there was this one community that sat on this unique expertise about this very important country, but because of its political lack of involvement, was not contributing to the discourse and to the debate and to the conversations. And we decided to see what we could do about that and make sure that we integrated the Iranian-American community more into the political process of this country compared to what they had been in before. And then, of course, when the talk of war, et cetera, became so prominent during the Bush administration, our ideas and our formula and the need for involvement became all the more apparent. And as a result, we quickly grew to become the largest Iranian-American grassroots organization in the country.
Unfortunately, we have time for one last question, a couple minutes. And so what I would like to do is, you have a lot of people here who are very much involved and concerned about what's going on. And yet there's sometimes here not a lot. They don't know exactly what is it that they can do to affect what's going on in Washington. There's not a lot we can do necessarily in Iran. But in the next, for you know, the next minute or so, can you tell us what you think everyone here in the audience can do, or people listening, to have an impact?
I think that's critical. I've thrown out this term a couple of times during this talk. I said the president did not have enough political space. Now, what does that mean? I'm talking about the political landscape, what does that mean? Well, that actually, it means you. That's what political space is. What does the landscape look like politically right now on this issue? Well, the way it looks is that the White House is under a tremendous amount of pressure from Congress not to show flexibility and the type of dedication to diplomacy that I think is needed. Congress is, in turn, under influence and pressure from various constituencies that are pushing them in that direction. And then there is this huge mass of people that are watching passively, perhaps have opinions to the contrary, but are not engaged in the process. And as a result, you have a situation in which, as the example I gave, in the rounds of talks in 2012, the negotiators indicate certain things that the U.S. can do in order to get the Iranians to give some concessions, and then Congress comes in and shuts the door on that. As long as that continues to be the case, where people are not involved, not communicating with their members of Congress, not supporting organizations such as Plowshares that is doing such an important job in expanding that political space, we will likely end up, unfortunately, missing the next opportunity. And if we're lucky, the next opportunity is not the last opportunity. But if it is, then we're going to be faced with some very dire consequences. So I encourage everyone, if you are inclined to agree that it is valuable to find a diplomatic solution, to get involved. And there's plenty of organizations. I think one good one-stop shop to go to is through Plowshares. since it is a grantor that has supported numerous organizations in a circle of groups that are working on this issue, to support them, to create that type of a political space that enables the solutions that ultimately are the only ways that we can find a peaceful outcome to this.
Well, we have come to that conclusion. Trita, thanks very much for that endorsement of Plowshares. Our thanks to Dr. Trita Parsi, founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening in this recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.